that families are built on mutual obligations and that family members need to help each other. Here's why combining allowances with chores is not good for kids. By linking money to the completion of chores, parents turn an allowance into an if-then reward. This sends kids a clear and clearly wrong-headed message. In the absence of a payment, no self-respecting child would willingly set the table, empty the garbage, or make her own bed. It converts a moral and familial obligation into just another commercial transaction, and teaches that the only reason to do a less than desirable task for your family is in exchange for payment. This is a case where combining two good things gives you less, not more. So keep allowance and chores separate, and you just might get that trash emptied. Even better, your kids will begin to learn the difference between principles and payoffs. 5. Offer praise the right way. Done right, praise is an important way to give kids feedback and encouragement. But done wrong, praise can become yet another if-then reward that can squash creativity and stifle intrinsic motivation. The powerful work of psychologist Carol Dweck, as well as others in the field, offers a how-to list for offering praise in a way that promotes type I behavior. 1. Praise effort and strategy, not intelligence. As Dweck's research has shown, children who are praised for being smart often believe that every encounter is a test of whether they really are. So to avoid looking dumb, they resist new challenges and choose the easiest path. By contrast, kids who understand that effort and hard work lead to mastery and growth are more willing to take on new, difficult tasks. 2. Make praise specific. Parents and teachers should give kids useful information about their performance. Instead of bathing them in generalities, tell them specifically what they've done that's noteworthy. 3. Praise in private. Praise is feedback, not an award ceremony. That's why it's often best to offer it one-on-one, in private. 4. Offer praise only when there's a good reason for it. Don't kid a kid. He can see through fake praise in a nanosecond. Be sincere or keep quiet. If you overpraise, kids regard it as dishonest and unearned. Plus, overpraising becomes another if-then reward that makes earning praise rather than moving toward mastery the objective. 6. Help kids see the big picture. In education systems tilted toward standardized tests, grades, and if-then rewards, students often have no idea why they're doing what they're doing. Turn that around by helping them glimpse the big picture. Whatever they're studying, be sure they can answer these questions. Why am I learning this? How is it relevant to the world I live in now? Then get out of the classroom and apply what they're studying. If they're learning Spanish, take them to an office, a store, or a community center where they can actually speak the language. If they're studying geometry, have them draw up architectural plans for an addition to your school or home. If they're taking history, ask them to apply what they've learned to an event in the news. Think of it as the fourth R: reading, writing, arithmetic, and relevance. 7. Check out these 5 Type I schools. Although most schools around the world are still built atop the Motivation 2.0 operating system, a number of forward-thinking educators have long understood that young people are brimming with the third drive. Here are 5 Type I schools in the United States with practices to emulate and stories to inspire. Big Picture Learning. Since 1996, with the opening of its flagship public high school, The Met, in Providence, Rhode Island, Big Picture Learning has been creating places that cultivate engagement rather than demand compliance. Founded by 2 veteran education innovators, Dennis Lipke and Elliot Washore, Big Picture is a nonprofit that now has 60-plus schools around the United States that put students in charge of their own education. Big Picture kids get the basics, but they also use those basics and acquire other skills by doing real work in the community, all under the guidance of an experienced adult tutor. And instead of easily gamed Motivation 2.0 measurements, big picture, kids are assessed the way adults are, on work performance, individual presentations, effort, attitude, and behavior on the job. Most of the students at the Met and other big picture schools are at-risk, low-income, and minority kids who've been poorly served by conventional schools. Yet thanks to this innovative Type I approach, more than 95% graduate and go on to college. For more information, go to www.bigpicture.org. Full disclosure, I have served unpaid on the board of directors of Big Picture since 2007. Sudbury Valley School. Take a look at this independent school in Framingham, Massachusetts, to see what happens when young kids have genuine autonomy. Working from the assumption that all human beings are naturally curious and that the best kind of learning happens when it's initiated and pursued by the one doing the learning, Sudbury Valley School gives its students total control over the task, time, and technique of their learning. Teachers and staff are there to help them make things happen. This is a school where engagement is the rule and compliance isn't an option. For more information, go to www.sudval.org. The Tinkering School. More of a lab than a school, this summer program, created by computer scientist Jeever Tully, lets children from 7 to 17 play around with interesting stuff and build cool things. At the headquarters in Montara, California, Tully's tinkerers have built working zip lines, motorcycles, toothbrush robots, roller coasters, and plastic bag bridges strong enough to hold people. Most of us aren't able to ship our kids out to California for a week of tinkering, but we can all learn the five dangerous things you should let your children do. So take 9 minutes to listen to Tully's 2007 online TED Talk of that title. Then hand your kids a pocket knife, some power tools, and a book of matches, and get out of the way. For more information, go to www.tinkeringschool.com, which includes a link to Tully's talk. Puget Sound Community School. Like Sudbury and Big Picture, this tiny independent school in Seattle, Washington, gives its students a radical dose of autonomy, turning the one-size-fits-all approach of conventional schools on its head. Each student has an advisor who acts as her personal coach, helping her come up with her own learning goals. School consists of a mixture of class time and self-created independent study projects, along with community service devised by the students. Since youngsters are often away from campus, they gain a clear sense that their learning has a real-world purpose. And rather than chase after grades, they receive frequent, informal feedback from advisors, teachers, and peers. For more information, go to www.pscs.org. Montessori Schools. Dr. Maria Montessori developed the Montessori method of teaching in the early 1900s after observing children's natural curiosity and innate desire to learn. Her early understanding of the third drive spawned a worldwide network of schools, mostly for preschool and primary age children. Many of the key tenets of a Montessori education resonate with the principles of Motivation 3.0. That children naturally engage in self-directed learning and independent study. That teachers should act as observers and facilitators of that learning and not as lecturers or commanders. And that children are naturally inclined to experience periods of intense focus, concentration, and flow that adults should do their best not to interrupt. Although Montessori schools are rare at the junior high and high school levels, every school, educator, and parent can learn from its enduring and successful approach. Meantime, while you're investigating Montessori, check out two other approaches to learning that also promote Type I behavior: the Reggio Emilia philosophy for the education of young children, and the Waldorf schools. For more information, visit these websites: www.montessori-ami.org, www.montessori.org, www.amshq.org, www.regioalliance.org, and www.ywaldorfworks.org. 8. Take a class from the unschoolers. In the United States, the homeschooling movement has been growing at a remarkable pace over the past 20 years. And the fastest growing segment of that movement is the unschoolers, families that don't use a formal curriculum and instead allow their children to explore and learn what interests them. Unschoolers have been among the first to adopt a Type I approach to education. They promote autonomy by allowing youngsters to decide what they learn and how they learn it. They encourage mastery by allowing children to spend as long as they'd like and go as deep as they desire on the topics that interest them. Even if unschooling is not for you or your kids, you can learn a thing or two from these educational innovators. Start by reading John Taylor Gatto's extraordinary book, Dumbing Us Down. Take a look at Home Education Magazine and its website. Then check out some of the many other unschooling sites on the web. For more information, go to www.homeedmag.com, www.unschooling.com, and www.sandratodd.com/unschooling. 9. Turn students into teachers. One of the best ways to know whether you've mastered something is to try to teach it. Give students that opportunity. Assign each pupil in a class a different aspect of the broader topic you're studying, and then have them take turns teaching what they've learned to their classmates. And once they've got it down, give them a wider audience by inviting other classes, teachers, parents, or school administrators to learn what they have to teach. Also, at the start of a school term, ask students about their individual passions and areas of expertise. Keep a list of your experts, and then call upon them as needed throughout the term. A classroom of teachers is a classroom of learners. The Type I Reading List, 15 Essential Books. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose are integral to the human condition, so it's no surprise that a number of writers, from psychologists to journalists to novelists, have explored these three elements and probed what they mean for our lives. This list of books isn't exhaustive, but it's a good starting point for anyone interested in cultivating a Type I life. I've arranged the books alphabetically by author, and at the end of each entry, I've included something called a Type I Insight, which is a quotation from the book. Finite and Infinite Games, A Vision of Life as Play and Possibility, by James P. Carse. In his elegant little book, religious scholar Carse describes two types of games. A finite game has a winner and an end. The goal is to triumph. An infinite game has no winner and no end. The goal is to keep playing. Non-winnable games, Carse explains, are much more rewarding than the win-lose ones we're accustomed to playing at our work and in our relationships. Type I Insight. Finite players play within boundaries. Infinite players play with boundaries. Talent is overrated. What really separates world-class performers from everybody else? By Jeff Colvin. What's the difference between those who are pretty good at what they do and those who are masters? Fortune magazine's Colvin scours the evidence and shows that the answer is threefold. Practice, practice, practice. But it's not just any practice, he says. The secret is deliberate practice. Highly repetitive, mentally demanding work that's often unpleasant, but undeniably effective. Type I Insight. If you set a goal of becoming an expert in your business, you would immediately start doing all kinds of things you don't do now. Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. It's tough to find a better argument for working hard at something you love than Csikszentmihalyi's landmark book on optimal experiences. Flow describes those exhilarating moments when we feel in control, full of purpose, and in the zone. And it reveals how people have turned even the most unpleasant tasks into enjoyable, rewarding challenges. Type I Insight. Contrary to what we usually believe, the best moments in our lives are not passive, receptive, relaxing times, although such experiences can be enjoyable if we have worked hard to attain them. The best moments usually occur when a person's mind or body is stretched to the limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. For more of Csikszentmihalyi's ideas, check out three of his other books, Finding Flow, The Psychology of Engagement with Everyday Life, Creativity, Flow and the Psychology of Discovery and Invention, and the classic, Beyond Boredom and Anxiety, Experiencing Flow in Work and Play. Why We Do What We Do, Understanding Self-Motivation by Edward L. Deci with Richard Flest. In 1995, Edward Deci wrote a short book that introduced his powerful theories to a popular audience. In clear, readable prose, he discusses the limitations of a society based on control, explains the origins of his landmark experiments, and shows how to promote autonomy in many realms of our lives. Type I Insight. The question so many people ask, namely, how do I motivate people to learn, to work, to do their chores, to take their medicine, are the wrong questions. They are wrong because they imply that motivation is something that gets done to people rather than something that people do. Mindset, The New Psychology of Success by Carol Dweck. Stanford's Dweck distills her decades of research to a simple pair of ideas. People can have two different mindsets, she says. Those with a fixed mindset believe that their talents and abilities are carved in stone. Those with a growth mindset believe that their talents and abilities can be developed. Fixed mindsets see every encounter as a test of their worthiness. Growth mindsets see the same encounters as opportunities to improve. Dweck's message, go with growth. Type I Insight. In the book and likewise on her website, www.mindsetonline.com, Dweck offers concrete steps for moving from a fixed to a growth mindset. 1. Learn to listen for a fixed mindset voice that might be hurting your resiliency. 2. Interpret challenges not as roadblocks, but as opportunities to stretch yourself. 3. Use the language of growth, for example, I'm not sure I can do it now, but I think I can learn with time and effort. Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris. This darkly hilarious debut novel is a cautionary tale for the demoralizing effects of the Type X workplace. At an unnamed ad agency in Chicago, people spend more time scarfing free donuts and scamming office chairs than doing actual work. All while fretting about walking Spanish down the hall, office lingo for being fired. Type I Insight. They had taken away our flowers, our summer days, and our bonuses. We were on a wage freeze and a hiring freeze, and people were flying out the door like so many dismantled dummies. We had one thing still going for us, the prospect of a promotion. A new title. True, it came with no money. The power was almost always illusory, the bestowal a cheap, shrewd device concocted by management to keep us from mutiny. But when word circulated that one of us had jumped up an acronym, that person was just a little quieter that day, took a longer lunch than usual, came back with shopping bags, spent the afternoon speaking softly into the telephone, and left whenever they wanted that night, while the rest of us sent emails flying back and forth on the lofty topics of injustice and uncertainty. Good Work, When Excellence and Ethics Meet by Howard Gardner, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, and William Damon. How can you do good work in an age of relentless market forces and lightning-fast technology? By considering three basic issues. Your profession's mission, its standards or best practices, and your own identity. Although this book focuses mainly on examples from the fields of genetics and journalism, its insights can be applied to a number of professions buffeted by changing times. The authors have also continued their effort to identify individuals and institutions that exemplify good work on their website, www.goodwork.org. Type I Insight. What do you do if you wake up in the morning and dread going to work because the daily routine no longer satisfies your standards? 1. Start groups or forums with others in your industry or outside it to reach beyond your current area of influence. 2. Work with existing organizations to confirm your profession's values or develop new guidelines. 3. take a stand. It can be risky, sure, but leaving a job for ethical reasons need not involve abandoning your professional goals. Outliers, The Story of Success by Malcolm Gladwell. With a series of compelling and gracefully told stories, Gladwell deftly takes a hammer to the idea of the self-made man. Success is more complicated, he says. High achievers, from young Canadian hockey players to Bill Gates to the Beatles, are often the products of hidden advantages of culture, timing, demographics, and luck that help them become masters in their fields. Reading this book will lead you to reevaluate your own path. More important, it will make you wonder how much human potential we're losing when so many people are denied these advantages. Type I Insight. It is not how much money we make that ultimately makes us happy between 9 to 5. It's whether our work fulfills us. If I offered you a choice between being an architect for $75,000 a year and working in a toll booth every day for the rest of your life for $100,000 a year, which would you take? I'm guessing the former, because there is complexity, autonomy, and a relationship between effort and reward in doing creative work, and that's worth more to most of us than money. Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln by Doris Kearns Goodwin. In her entertaining popular history, Goodwin shows Abraham Lincoln as an exemplar of type I behavior. He worked mightily to achieve mastery in law and politics. He gave his staunchest rivals power and autonomy, and he developed a leadership style rooted in a higher purpose, ending slavery and keeping the Union intact. Type I Insight. Goodwin sheds light on Lincoln's Type I leadership skills. Among them, he was self-confident enough to surround himself with rivals who excelled in areas where he was weak. He genuinely listened to other people's points of view, which helped him form more complex opinions of his own. He gave credit where it was due and wasn't afraid to take the blame. The Amateurs, The Story of Four Young Men and Their Quest for an Olympic Gold Medal by David Halberstam. What would compel a group of men to endure untold physical pain and exhaustion for a sport that promised no monetary compensation or fame? That's the question at the heart of Halberstam's riveting narrative about the 1984 U.S. rowing trials, a book that offers a glimpse into the fires of intrinsic motivation. Type I Insight. No chartered planes or buses ferried the athletes into Princeton. No team managers hustled their baggage from the bus to the hotel desk and made arrangements so that at mealtime they need only show up and sign a tab. This was a world of hitched rides and borrowed beds, and meals, if not scrounge, were desperately budgeted by appallingly hungry young men. Punished by Rewards, The Trouble with Gold Stars, Incentive Plans, A's, Praise, and Other Bribes by Alfie Cohn. Former teacher Cohn throws down the gauntlet at society's blind acceptance of B.F. Skinner's Do This and You'll Get That theory of behaviorism. This 1993 book ranges across school, work, and private life in its indictment of extrinsic motivators and paints a compelling picture of a world without them. Type I Insight. Do rewards motivate people? Absolutely. They motivate people to get rewards. Cohn has written 11 books on parenting, education, and behavior, as well as scores of articles on that topic, all of which are interesting and provocative. There's more information on his website, www.alfiecohn.org. Once a Runner by John L. Parker, Jr. Parker's novel, originally published in 1978 and kept alive by a devoted coterie of fans, offers a fascinating look into the psychology of distance running. Through the tale of college miler Quentin Cassidy, we see the toll that mastery can take and the thrill it can produce when it's realized. Type I Insight. He ran not for crypto-religious reasons, but to win races, to cover ground fast, not only to be better than his fellows, but better than himself, to be faster by a tenth of a second, by an inch, by 2 feet or 2 yards than he had been the week or year before. He sought to conquer the physical limitations placed on him by the three-dimensional world. And if time is the fourth dimension, that too was his province. If he could conquer the weakness, the cowardice in himself, he would not worry about the rest. It would come. The War of Art, Break Through the Blocks and Win Your Inner Creative Battles, by Stephen Pressfield. Pressfield's potent book is both a wise meditation on the obstacles that stand in the way of creative freedom and a spirited battle plan for overcoming the resistance that arises when we set out to do something great. If you're looking for a quick jolt on your journey toward mastery, this is it. Type I insight. It may be that the human race is not ready for freedom. The air of liberty may be too rarefied for us to breathe. Certainly, I wouldn't be writing this book on this subject if living with freedom were easy. The paradox seems to be, as Socrates demonstrated long ago, that the truly free individual is free only to the extent of his own self-mastery, while those who will not govern themselves are condemned to find masters to govern over them. Maverick, The Success Story Behind the World's Most Unusual Workplace, by Ricardo Semler. While many bosses are control freaks, Semler might be the first autonomy freak. He transformed the Brazilian manufacturing firm Semco through a series of radical steps. He canned most executives, eliminated job titles, let the company's 3,000 employees set their own hours, gave everyone a vote in big decisions, and even let some workers determine their own salaries. The result? Under Semler's non-command, Semco has grown 20% a year for the past two decades. This book, along with Semler's more recent The 7-Day Weekend, shows how to put his iconoclastic and effective philosophy into action. Type I insight. I want everyone at Semco to be self-sufficient. The company is organized. Well, maybe that's not quite the right word for us. Not to depend too much on any individual, especially me. I take it as a point of pride that twice on my return from long trips, my office had been moved. And each time, it got smaller. The Fifth Discipline, The Art and Practice of the Learning Organization, by Peter M. Senge. In his management classic, Senge introduces readers to learning organizations, where autonomous thinking and shared visions for the future are not only encouraged, but are considered vital to the health of the organization. Senge's five disciplines offer a smart organizational companion to Type I behavior. Type I insight. People with a high level of personal mastery are able to consistently realize the results that matter most deeply to them. In effect, they approach their life as an artist would approach a work of art. They do that by becoming committed to their own lifelong learning. Listen to the gurus, six business thinkers who get it. While the list of companies that embrace Type I thinking is distressingly short, the blueprints for building such organizations are readily available. The following six business thinkers offer some wise guidance for designing organizations that promote autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Douglas McGregor. Who? A social psychologist and one of the first professors at MIT's Sloan School of Management. His landmark 1960 book, The Human Side of Enterprise, gave the practice of management a badly needed shot of humanism. Big idea. Theory X versus Theory Y. McGregor described two very different approaches to management, each based on a different assumption about human behavior. The first approach, which he called Theory X, assumed that people avoid effort, work only for money and security, and therefore need to be controlled. The second, which he called Theory Y, assumed that work is as natural for human beings as play or rest, that initiative and creativity are widespread, and that if people are committed to a goal, they will actually seek responsibility. Theory Y, he argued, was the more accurate and ultimately more effective approach. Type I insight. Managers frequently complain to me about the fact that subordinates nowadays won't take responsibility. I have been interested to note how often these same managers keep a constant surveillance over the day-to-day performance of subordinates, sometimes two or three levels below themselves. More info. As I explained in Chapter 3, the human side of enterprise is a key ancestor of Motivation 3.0. Although McGregor wrote the book a full 50 years ago, his observations about the limits of control remain smart, fresh, and relevant. Peter F. Drucker, who? The most influential management thinker of the 20th century. He wrote an astonishing 41 books, influenced the thinking of two generations of CEOs, received a U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom, and taught for 3 decades at the Claremont Graduate University Business School that now bears his name. Big idea. Self-management. Drucker's primary contribution is not a single idea, Jim Collins once wrote, but rather an entire body of work that has one gigantic advantage. Nearly all of it is essentially right. Drucker coined the term knowledge worker, foresaw the rise of the nonprofit sector, and was among the first to stress the primacy of the customer in business strategy. But although he's best known for his thoughts on managing businesses, toward the end of his career, Drucker signaled the next frontier, self-management. With the rise of individual longevity and the decline of job security, he argued, individuals have to think hard about where their strengths lie, what they can contribute, and how they can improve their own performance. The need to manage oneself, he wrote shortly before he died in 2005, is creating a revolution in human affairs. Type I insight. Demanding of knowledge workers that they define their own task and its results is necessary because knowledge workers must be autonomous. Workers should be asked to think through their own work plans and then to submit them. What am I going to focus on? What results can be expected for which I should be held accountable? By what deadline? More info. Drucker wrote many books, and many have been written about him. But a great starting place is The Daily Drucker, a small gem that provides 366 insights and action points for putting his ideas into practice. On the topic of self-management, read Drucker's 2005 Harvard Business Review article, Managing Oneself. For more information and access to digital archives of his writing, check out www.druckerinstitute.com. Jim Collins. Who? One of the most authoritative voices in business today and the author of Built to Last with Jerry Porras, Good to Great, and most recently, How the Mighty Fall. A former professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, he now operates his own management lab in Boulder, Colorado. Big idea. Self-motivation and greatness. Expending energy trying to motivate people is largely a waste of time, Collins wrote in Good to Great. If you have the right people on the bus, they will be self-motivated. The real question then becomes, how do you manage in such a way as not to demotivate people? Type I insight. Collins suggests 4 basic practices for creating a culture where self-motivation can flourish. 1. Lead with questions, not answers. 2. Engage in dialogue and debate, not coercion. 3. Conduct autopsies without blame. 4. Build red flag mechanisms. In other words, make it easy for employees and customers to speak up when they identify a problem. More info. Collins's website, www.jimcollins.com, contains more information about his work, as well as excellent diagnostic tools, guides, and videos. Cali wrestler and Jody Thompson. Who? These 2 former human resources professionals at Best Buy persuaded their CEO to experiment with a radical new approach to organizing work. They wrote a book about their experiences, Why Work Sucks and How to Fix It, and now run their own consultancy. Big idea. The results-only work environment. Roe, described in Chapter 4, affords employees complete autonomy over when, where, and how they do their work. The only thing that matters is results. Type I insight. The basic tenets of Roe include People at all levels stop doing any activity that is a waste of their time, the customer's time, or their company's time. Employees have the freedom to work any way they want. Every meeting is optional. There are no work schedules. More info. You can learn more about Roe at their website, www.culturerx.com. Gary Hamel. Who? The world's leading expert on business strategy, according to Business Week. He's the co-author of the influential book Competing for the Future, a professor at the London Business School, and the director of the California-based M-Lab, where he's spearheading the pursuit of moonshots for management, a set of huge challenges to reform the theory and practice of running organizations. Big idea. Management is an outdated technology. Hamel likens management to the internal combustion engine, a technology that has largely stopped evolving. Put a 1960s-era CEO in a time machine and transport him to 2010, Hamel says, and that CEO would find a great many of today's management rituals little changed from those that governed corporate life a generation or two ago. Small wonder, Hamel explains. Most of the essential tools and techniques of modern management were invented by individuals born in the 19th century, not long after the end of the American Civil War. The solution? A radical overhaul of this aging technology. Type I insight. The next time you're in a meeting and folks are discussing how to wring another increment of performance out of your workforce, you might ask, to what end and to whose benefit are our employees being asked to give of themselves? Have we committed ourselves to a purpose that is truly deserving of their initiative, imagination, and passion? More info. Hamel's The Future of Management, written with Bill Breen, is an important read. For more of Hamel's ideas and research, see www.garyhamel.com and www.managementlab.org. The Type I Fitness Plan. 4 tips for getting and staying motivated to exercise. On the cover of this audiobook is a runner, and that's no accident. Running can have all the elements of type I behavior. It's autonomous, it allows you to seek mastery, and the people who keep at it and enjoy it most often run toward a greater purpose, testing their limits or staying healthy and vital. To help you bring the spirit of intrinsic motivation out of the office and classroom and into another realm of your life, here are 4 tips for staying fit the type I way. 1. Set your own goals. Don't accept some standardized cookie-cutter exercise plan. Create one that's tailored to your needs and fitness level. You can work with a professional on this, but you make the final calls. Equally important, set the right kinds of goals. Ample research in behavioral science shows that people who seek to lose weight for extrinsic reasons, to slim down for a wedding, or to look better at a class reunion, often reach their goals. And then they gain the weight back as soon as the target event ends. Meanwhile, people who pursue more intrinsic goals, to get fit in order to feel good, or to stay healthy for their family, make slower progress at first, but achieve significantly better results in the long term. 2. Ditch the treadmill. Unless you really like treadmills, that is. If trudging to the gym feels like a dreary obligation, find a form of fitness you enjoy that produces those intoxicating moments of flow. Gather some friends for an informal game of tennis or basketball. Join an amateur league. Go for walks at a local park. Dance for a half hour. Or play with your kids. Use the Sawyer effect to your advantage and turn your workout into play. 3. Keep mastery in mind. Getting better at something provides a great source of renewable energy. So pick an activity in which you can improve over time. By continually increasing the difficulty of what you take on, think Goldilocks, and setting more audacious challenges for yourself as time passes, you can renew that energy and stay motivated. 4. Reward yourself the right way. If you're really struggling, consider a quick experiment with STICK. www.stickk.com. That's a website in which you publicly commit to a goal and must hand over money to a friend, a charity, or an anti-charity if you fail to reach it. But in general, don't bribe yourself with if-then rewards, like, if I exercise 4 times this week, then I'll buy myself a new shirt. They can backfire. But the occasional now that reward? Not a problem. So if you've swum the distance you hope to this week, there's no harm in treating yourself to a massage afterward. It won't hurt, and it might feel good. Drive, the recap. This audiobook has covered a lot of ground, and you might not be able to instantly recall everything in it. So here's a chapter-by-chapter summary of Drive. Think of it as your talking points, refresher course, or memory jogger. Introduction, the puzzling puzzles of Harry Harlow and Edward Deci. Human beings have a biological drive that includes hunger, thirst, and sex. We also have another long-recognized drive, to respond to rewards and punishments in our environment. But in the middle of the 20th century, a few scientists began discovering that humans also have a third drive, what some call intrinsic motivation. For several decades, behavioral scientists have been figuring out the dynamics and explaining the power of our third drive. Alas, business hasn't caught up to this new understanding. If we want to strengthen companies, elevate our lives, and improve the world, we need to close the gap between what science knows and what business does. Part 1, A New Operating System. Chapter 1, The Rise and Fall of Motivation 2.0. Societies, like computers, have operating systems, a set of mostly invisible instructions and protocols on which everything runs. The first human operating system, call it Motivation 1.0, was all about survival. Its successor, Motivation 2.0, was built around external rewards and punishments. That worked fine for routine 20th century tasks. But in the 21st century, Motivation 2.0 is proving incompatible with how we organize what we do, how we think about what we do, and how we do what we do. We need an upgrade. Chapter 2. 7 Reasons Carrots and Sticks Often Don't Work. When carrots and sticks encounter our third drive, strange things begin to happen. Traditional if-then rewards can give us less of what we want. They can extinguish intrinsic motivation, diminish performance, crush creativity, and crowd out good behavior. They can also give us more of what we don't want. They can encourage unethical behavior, create addictions, and foster short-term thinking. These are the bugs in our current operating system. Chapter 2A, and the special circumstances when they do. Carrots and sticks aren't all bad. They can be effective for rule-based routine tasks because there's little intrinsic motivation to undermine and not much creativity to crush. And they can be more effective still if those giving such rewards offer a rationale for why the task is necessary, acknowledge that it's boring, and allow people autonomy over how they complete it. For non-routine conceptual tasks, rewards are more perilous, particularly those of the if-then variety. But now that rewards, non-contingent rewards given after a task is complete, can sometimes be okay for more creative right-brain work, especially if they provide useful information about performance. Chapter 3. Type I and Type X. Motivation 2.0 depended on and fostered Type X behavior. Behavior fueled more by extrinsic desires than intrinsic ones, and concerned less with the inherent satisfaction of an activity and more with the external rewards to which an activity leads. Motivation 3.0, the upgrade that's necessary for the smooth functioning of 21st century business, depends on and fosters Type I behavior. Type I behavior concerns itself less with the external rewards an activity brings and more with the inherent satisfaction of the activity itself. For professional success and personal fulfillment, we need to move ourselves and our colleagues from Type X to Type I. The good news is that Type I's are made, not born, and Type I behavior leads to stronger performance, greater health, and higher overall well-being. Part 2. The Three Elements. Chapter 4. Autonomy. Our default setting is to be autonomous and self-directed. Unfortunately, circumstances, including outdated notions of management, often conspire to change that default setting and turn us from type I to type X. To encourage type I behavior and the high performance it enables, the first requirement is autonomy. People need autonomy over task, what they do, time, when they do it, team, who they do it with, and technique, how they do it. Companies that offer autonomy, sometimes in radical doses, are outperforming their competitors. Chapter 5, Mastery. While Motivation 2.0 required compliance, Motivation 3.0 demands engagement. Only engagement can produce mastery, becoming better at something that matters. And the pursuit of mastery, an important but often dormant part of our third drive, has become essential to making one's way in the economy. Mastery begins with flow, optimal experiences when the challenges we face are exquisitely matched to our abilities. Smart workplaces therefore supplement day-to-day activities with Goldilocks tasks, not too hard and not too easy. But mastery also abides by three peculiar rules. Mastery is a mindset. It requires the capacity to see your abilities not as finite, but as infinitely improvable. Mastery is a pain. It demands effort, grit, and deliberate practice. And mastery is an asymptote. It's impossible to fully realize, which makes it simultaneously frustrating and alluring. Chapter 6, Purpose. Humans, by their nature, seek purpose, a cause greater and more enduring than themselves. But traditional businesses have long considered purpose ornamental, a perfectly nice accessory so long as it didn't get in the way of the important things. But that's changing, thanks in part to the rising tide of aging baby boomers reckoning with their own mortality. In Motivation 3.0, purpose maximization is taking its place alongside profit maximization as an aspiration and a guiding principle. Within organizations, this new purpose motive is expressing itself in three ways: in goals that use profit to reach purpose, in words that emphasize more than self-interest, and in policies that allow people to pursue purpose on their own terms. This move to accompany profit maximization with purpose maximization has the potential to rejuvenate our businesses and remake our world. Drive, the glossary. A new approach to motivation requires a new vocabulary for talking about it. Here's your official Drive dictionary. Baseline rewards. Salary, contract payments, benefits, and a few perks that represent the floor for compensation. If someone's baseline rewards aren't adequate or equitable, her focus will be on the unfairness of her situation or the anxiety of her circumstance, making motivation of any sort extremely difficult. FedEx Days. Created by the Australian software company Atlassian, these one-day bursts of autonomy allow employees to tackle any problem they want and then show the results to the rest of the company at the end of 24 hours. Why the name? Because you have to deliver something overnight. Goldilocks tasks. The sweet spot where tasks are neither too easy nor too hard. Essential to reaching the state of flow and to achieving mastery. If-then rewards. Rewards offered as contingencies, as in, if you do this, then you'll get that. For routine tasks, if-then rewards can sometimes be effective. For creative conceptual tasks, they invariably do more harm than good. Mastery asymptote. The knowledge that full mastery can never be realized, which is what makes its pursuit simultaneously alluring and frustrating. Motivation 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. The motivational operating systems, or sets of assumptions and protocols about how the world works and how humans behave, that run beneath our laws, economic arrangements, and business practices. Motivation 1.0 presumed that humans were biological creatures struggling for survival. Motivation 2.0 presumed that humans also responded to rewards and punishments in their environment. Motivation 3.0, the upgrade we now need, presumes that humans also have a third drive to learn, to create, and to better the world. Non-routine work. Creative, conceptual, right-brain work that can't be reduced to a set of rules. Today, if you're not doing this sort of work, you won't be doing what you're doing much longer. Now that rewards. Rewards offered after a task has been completed, as in, now that you've done such a great job, let's acknowledge the achievement. Now that rewards, while tricky, are less perilous for non-routine tasks than if-then rewards. Results-only work environment, or RO. The brainchild of two American consultants, a RO is a workplace in which employees don't have schedules. They don't have to be in the office at a certain time or any time. They just have to get their work done. Routine work. Work that can be reduced to a script, a spec sheet, a formula, or a set of instructions. External rewards can be effective in motivating routine tasks. But because such algorithmic, rule-based left-brain work has become easier to send offshore and to automate, this type of work has become less valuable and less important in advanced economies. Sawyer effect. A weird behavioral alchemy inspired by the scene in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, in which Tom and friends whitewash Aunt Polly's fence. This effect has two aspects. The negative, rewards can turn play into work. The positive, focusing on mastery can turn work into play. 20% time. An initiative in place at a few companies in which employees can spend 20% of their time working on any project they choose. Type I behavior. A way of thinking and an approach to life built around intrinsic rather than extrinsic motivators. It is powered by our innate need to direct our own lives, to learn and create new things, and to do better by ourselves and our world. Type X behavior. Behavior that is fueled more by extrinsic desires than intrinsic ones, and that concerns itself less with the inherent satisfaction of an activity and more with the external rewards to which that activity leads. The Drive Discussion Guide, 20 conversation starters to keep you thinking and talking. These days, authors might get the first word, but they don't and shouldn't get the last word. That's your job. So now that you've listened to this book, go out and laud or lash it on your blog or favorite social networking site. But if you want to make the ideas and drive truly come alive, talk them over in person with some colleagues from work, friends at school, or your book club. That's how the world changes, conversation by conversation. Here are 20 questions to get your conversation going. 1. Have I persuaded you about the gap between what science knows and what organizations do? Do you agree that we need to upgrade our motivational operating system? Why or why not? 2. How has Motivation 2.0 affected your experiences at school, at work, or in family life? If Motivation 3.0 had been the prevailing ethic when you were young, how would your experiences have differed? 3. Do you consider yourself more type I or type X? Why? Think of three people in your life, whether at home, work, or school. Are they more type I or type X? What leads you to your conclusions? 4. Describe a time when you've seen one of the 7 deadly flaws of carrots and sticks in action. What lessons might you and others learn from that experience? Have you seen instances when carrots and sticks have been effective? 5. How well is your current job meeting your need for baseline rewards, salary, benefits, and a few perks? If it's falling short, what changes can you or your organization make? 6. In this audiobook, I draw a distinction between routine work and non-routine work. How much of your own work is routine? How much is non-routine? 7. If you're a boss, how might you replace if-then rewards with a more autonomous environment and the occasional now-that reward? 8. As you think about your own best work, what aspect of autonomy has been most important to you? autonomy over what you do, task, when you do it, time, how you do it, technique, or with whom you do it, team. Why? How much autonomy do you have at work right now? Is that enough? 9. Would initiatives like FedEx Days, 20% time in a row, work in your organization? Why or why not? What are one or two other ideas that would bring out more type I behavior in your workplace? 10. Describe a time recently when you've experienced flow. What were you doing? Where were you? How might you tweak your current role to bring on more of these optimal experiences? 11. Is there anything you've ever wanted to master that you've avoided for reasons like, I'm too old, or I'll never be good at that, or it would be a waste of time? What are the barriers to giving it a try? How can you remove those barriers? 12. Are you in a position to delegate any of the tasks that might be holding you back from more challenging pursuits? How might you hand off these tasks in a way that does not take away your colleagues' autonomy? 13. How would you redesign your office, your classroom, or your home, the physical environment, the processes, the rules, to promote greater engagement and mastery by everyone? 14. When tackling the routine tasks your job requires, what strategies can you come up with to trigger the positive side of the Sawyer effect? 15. Drive talks a lot about purpose, both for organizations and individuals. Does your organization have a purpose? What is it? If your organization is for profit, is purpose even a realistic goal given the competitive pressures in every industry? 16. Are you, in your paid work, family life, or volunteering, on a path toward purpose? What is that purpose? 17. Is education today too type X? That is, does it put too great an emphasis on extrinsic rewards? If so, how should we reconfigure schools and classrooms? Is there an elegant way to reconcile intrinsic motivation and accountability? 18. If you're a mom or dad, does your home environment promote more type I or type X behavior in your child or children? How? What, if anything, should you do about it? 19. Do you think I underplay the importance of earning a living? Is my view of motivation 3.0 a bit too utopian? 20. What are the things that truly motivate you? Now think about the last week. How many of those 168 hours were devoted to these things? Can you do better? Feel free to add your own questions, and if you'd like your question included in the discussion guide for future editions of Drive, send it directly to me at dhp@danpink.com. You can find out more about yourself in this topic. Are you type I or type X? Take the comprehensive free online assessment at www.danpink.com/drive.html. Interested in regular updates on the science and practice of human motivation? Subscribe to Drive Times, a free quarterly email newsletter at www.danpink.com/drive.html. This is Daniel H. Pink. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Dan Musselman. Drive is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Books on Tape. Copyright 2010, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.